Monday, Sunday night, 8 p.m., WLRN in South Florida, WKWM in the Florida Keys, and WLRN.org.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to Topical Currents. I'm Bonnie Berman, Joseph Cooper, still away. Well, countless studies and books have considered the effect parents have on their children at every stage of their lives. But what about the effect kids have on their parents? And although for better or for worse, children have always reshaped their parents' lives, how have the roles of mothers and fathers been altered in the last 50 years? Joining us now is award-winning journalist, author, and New York Magazine contributing editor, Jennifer Senior. Based on her 2010 cover article for the magazine, she's written All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And Jennifer Senior joins us from NPR in New York City. Welcome.
Hey, thanks so much.
Well, thanks for being here. Well, let's just look at the title of your book. What do you mean by that, All Joy and No Fun?
You know, I cribbed it from a friend of mine who had become a new dad, and this was years ago. One of us asked him, you know, how do you like it? And that was his answer.
And what did he mean? So,
well, I mean, I think what he meant, I mean, look, he was in the trenches at that stage. Those are the bunker moments, right? You know, early parenthood when you're getting absolutely no sleep. It's still true partially, I guess, you know, if you look at, I mean, I'll break down the social science in a moment, but what he meant is that, you know, never in his life had he experienced such unrivaled joy that he felt this deep and abiding connection to another human being that he did not think possible, and a kind of transcendent, you know, sense that he didn't think ever was possible, that some trapdoor had kind of opened up in his heart. But I think moment to moment, he was sleepless, you know, his autonomy had sort of been upended, and, you know, he was finding that, like, moment to moment, his well-being had been compromised. And that was what sort of opened up, you know, what you had said in your teaser that my story in 2010 argued that parents are less happy. I don't argue that. This is a very robust finding in social science, mm-hmm. that parents don't tend to be quite as happy as their childless peers. And what I wanted to do in 2010 was interrogate that finding, because it struck me as both right and as also totally missing something. I mean, I didn't think it was, I thought it was worth sort of trying to figure out why this was a consistent finding in social science. And so that's what that piece did. And my book, you know, happy schmappy. I mean, I wasn't really all that interested in that question in my book. But I land on it in my, you know, final chapter. And in sort of the middle, I do talk about what the, you know, kind of joys are of parenting that escape measure maybe by social science at the moment.
Right. And you talk about that experiencing self versus the...
I do.
Well, we'll talk about that study. So you focus on a specific socioeconomic group. I want to put that out there first. Tell us who you've researched and interviewed. And are you only focusing on Americans?
Yeah, no, these are great questions. And thank you for, like, you know, I think getting the framework right away. So I focused on middle-class parents. I did not focus on upper-middle-class parents particularly, and I certainly didn't focus on rich parents, because once you are in the precincts of the elite, you have an entirely different situation on your hands, and money can be sort of dispatched to, you know, ease certain problems. But I did not also focus on poor parents, and I had to make that very clear in my introduction, because the problems of poverty and the problems of parenting are very hard to sort of string apart. If you are commuting 2.5 hours each way to your minimum wage job and you don't know where to put your child or your children while you're going to that job, and then you don't know how to make ends meet for your kids and serve them, you know, nutritional meals because you're not making enough money, are those poverty problems or are those parenting problems? You know, they're both. So I think that poor parents deserve many, many books of their own. They could not, you know, my book couldn't do that. Its scope would be too broad and too unwieldy. So I focused only on the middle of the bell curve as best as I could find it. I didn't stay in New York for it. I went to Minnesota and I went to Texas. I went to, you know, different parts of the country to kind of look at, you know, different cross sections of parents in terms of their race and their professions, and, their races and professions and religions and all that. But I did not like look at, you know, socioeconomically. I did not go at the tippy top or the bottom. And it's America. I look at the United States.
Okay. And what about urban versus suburban or rural? Did you cover all that?
Right, another great question. So, I mean, you know, when I was in Minnesota, I mean, that's a, you know, Minneapolis and St. Paul are kind of mid-sized-ish cities, and I went to their suburbs and their exurbs. I went to Houston and their suburbs and exurbs. I went to kind of the last part of my book takes place in the part of Brooklyn that has houses with driveways, which
right.
is unusual.
Uh-huh.
But I did not get to rural areas, and it would have been great if I had, and I didn't.
Okay. So we just have the framework now for,
yeah,
you
thank
know,
you.
A lot of
and
research.
No one's asked me that question about rural versus, it's a really useful question. You're absolutely, yeah, no one's thought to do that.
Right, okay.
To ask.
So as I mentioned in the introduction, children obviously have always created changes in the lives of their parents, but you say that the last 50 years have seen radical differences. So let's look at some of those differences, and what is their source?
Yeah, okay. So great question. So there are three biggies that I would isolate. The first is that only until fairly recently did we have any choice about how many children we had or how far apart we spaced them and when we had them. You know, the advent of the pill was really the big, big thing. There were, of course, other forms of birth control preceding it. But family planning really is a very crucial difference. And it sounds obvious on its face, but let me just point out, like, a couple of things. In Plymouth Colony, there were 8 kids per family. In 1850, there were 5 kids per family. And now there are 2. Mm. So just imagine what kind of value we assign to each kid and what kind of value we assign to child rearing and raising children in general. We assign a very high tag to this, right? And also a very high value to this. And also, if you are a middle-class woman, if you have a college education, you defer child rearing until you are 30.3 years old.
Is that the age now? 30.3?
That's the 30.3, according to, yes, to national statistics.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that's nationwide. So imagine what it's like in urban centers, right? You know, it's got to be even higher, one assumes. So, and this is, again, only for college-educated women. But, I mean, that is like a decade, practically, of autonomy between graduating from college and starting your family. And it's a lot of time to get used to running and governing your own life. That is a very, very big change. So that's one thing, I think, choice. Another thing is that we work different. So if we work different, we're going to parent different. It used to be that if you got a phone call during dinner from your office, that meant one thing. That meant you were a doctor, right?
Right,
it was like
right.
it. But now many of us are interrupted all the time by our office, you know, our places of work, which means, and if we have the ability to work all the time, it means we have the ability to feel guilty all of the time. And I can't tell you how many parents, this is the big perversity to me, how many parents talk to me about feeling like their kids are interrupting them when they're doing their email and not the other way around. And I am the exact same way, by the way.
As a parent, you mean?
Yeah, you know, okay. That like your kid comes up to you and you're shooing. And the other way we work different is that, you know, women do it, right? I mean, we now have so many women in the workforce, and we still have no good rules for how to govern, like, kind of the domestic division of labor at home. We're still fighting about chores in the house, and it generates tons of tension now that both mom and dad are breadwinners. This is the number one thing that men and women fight about if there's a kid at home. It's not sex, it's not money, it's chores. So that's the second thing. And the third thing, and the biggest thing, I think, is the role of the child, right? Kids used to work. And this was not ethical, but it's what it was. And now we work for our kids, basically. We, rather than, you know, them working for us and contributing money to the family till, we work for them. The modern sheltered, education-focused childhood is barely 70 years old. It really only started after the Second World War. And we are now at the point where mothers spend more time with their children than they did in the 1960s, you know, which is extraordinary if you think about it. But the reason is that we all now feel that the only way our kids have a chance at living a middle-class life is if we create an entire species of superchild, you know, where we cultivate them within an inch of their lives. We teach them, you know, violin, and we tutor them, and we check their homework, and we take them to soccer practice. We do all of these things so that they have a fighting chance, you know, to get a toehold in this ever-shrinking middle class and this world where income inequality is growing. So that is just an enormous change. It used to be that kids were economic assets and didn't cost you money. And now they cost you dearly. They cost you a lot of money. That is huge.
We're speaking with Jennifer Senior. She's an award-winning journalist, contributing editor at New York Magazine, and an author. And her book is entitled All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And we need to take a short break on today's topical currents, but we're definitely going to open the phones and the email when we return. So please stay with us.
May is Miami Museum Month. During the month of May, you can enjoy buy one and get one free admission, or you can join one museum and see them all at participating museums. What better way to take advantage of all of Miami's museums? Details at miamimuseummonth.com for a full list of participants. Miami Museum Month is organized by the Greater Miami Convention and Visitors Bureau.
Is there someone you've forgotten for Mother's Day?
Not to worry. WLRN is here to help at WLRNradio.org.
For a $120 gift of support to WLRN, Field of Flowers will send along a beautiful basket of mixed flowers with your personal message.
And delivery is guaranteed by this Sunday, Mother's Day, anywhere in the contiguous U.S.
You can send your love and support your favorite radio station at WLRNradio.org or at 1-866-247-9576.
And thanks.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman with you. We're visiting with Jennifer Senior, an award-winning journalist and author and contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her book is entitled All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. And as promised, if you want to join in our conversation, perhaps you're a parent or you're about to be, or you want to weigh in on how you were parented, either way, you can join us at 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or you can email radio@WLRN.org. Jennifer, when you were speaking about, you know, that we have fewer children and we put so much stock in them, I was thinking about this need, it seems, to have the most exceptional children. It's as though no children are average any longer. And I'm wondering what that pressure places on, what kind of pressure that is on the child and false expectations for the parents as well.
Right. It's a great question. There's been a lot of literature about, you know, what kind of pressures kids experience, right? And there was that documentary, Race to Nowhere. I was focusing on how this affects parents. My whole book is about parents. I make it very clear in the beginning that this is not a book about how to raise your kid, and that I don't have any, you know, that there's nothing prescriptive in my book, that it's descriptive. But I think we're seeing a few things, right? Obviously, one thing that I got when I was doing my book tour is, like, particularly this happened to me when I was talking at a bookstore in San Francisco. A dean from Stanford came running up to me and said, all of the kids who show up at Stanford are under-constructed. They are, they've been overprotected. They've been sheltered so aggressively that they can't, that they lack a certain kind of fundamental resilience. And I think we're seeing, you know, an emergent literature that sort of says as much. The pressure to be a super child, I mean, it strikes me that it can't be healthy for any person, parent or child, to sustain as much pressure as we currently put on them. But the way that I was looking at this was very sympathetically, saying that, like, I was trying to deconstruct all the social forces that got us here. Why are we doing this? Why is everyone doing this? And I think much of it can be attributed to economic anxiety. You know, that wages have been stagnating for the middle class since the 1970s. And everybody is terrified that their children won't have a, you know, the same kind of life that they did, let alone a better life.
Right.
And that I think globalization has really ratcheted up people's anxieties. I mean, a mother in Minneapolis, I asked her what was like the driver of all these things that she, because she had this highly booked, I mean, she had this very intense schedule for her four kids. They were, it was a really dense, compressed, you know, every day, you know, something, you know, like seven things going on kind of schedule. And I said to her, and she didn't have many means. I should also point that out. She was not a woman who had tons of money. And I said to her, you know, why are you doing it? And her answer was instantaneous. She said, Tom Friedman. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, the world is flat. You know, I just read it and I thought, oh my God, my kid is going to be competing with these kids in Bangalore. And I said, but don't you feel like your kids have all these natural advantages? You know, they are born. I mean, here's what no one has done. No one has looked to see whether all of these efforts on the parts of parents are materially changing the outcomes for our kids. It could be that her kids could do only one extracurricular activity a week, and they would still do really, really well in life because they've been born with so many advantages. They have her as a mom, and she's really smart, and she's really nurturing, and she reads them books, and they have lots of books in the house. And they're born in one of the, you know, kind of luckiest places to be born, the United States. You know, this was a white family in a middle-class suburb in a safe place. I mean, they have lots of natural advantages, and no one trusts those natural advantages anymore. They think that they've got to, you know, as you point out, only be above average. It's like a nation of, like, woebegone, above-average children, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to know whether or not these things are making a difference.
Do you think it would be beneficial if parents lessened activities with their children and increased their quality time with them? It seems like they're always taking them somewhere.
I know. I'm very loath to weigh in. I'm
right,
very sympathetic
right.
to everybody. You know, like my whole perspective is I'm trying to figure out how we got here and to deconstruct it
right.
so that nobody feels bad about doing it and everybody understands why they're doing it. If you squint and you read between the lines, you'll see that like there is definitely some part of me that is questioning throughout like whether we are all driving ourselves a bit too crazy. And, you know, but I mean, I'm not in the business of wagging my finger at anyone and telling them how to reorganize their lives. I'm only trying to show that we are perhaps making ourselves slightly nutty. I mean, I think that when kids are less scheduled, it does seem like they are better able to tolerate boredom. And I am sure that there are virtues to being able to tolerate boredom. On the other hand, the only thing kids know now is being scheduled. And it's not even the parents who are doing it. The minute you put a kid in pre-K, that kid, their time is blocked out in 15-minute increments. Now we will have circle time. Now we will have music time. Now we will have art time. Now we will have gym. It's much more structured. Pre-K is longer. It used to be just a couple of days a week. It was 3 hours. Now lots of pre-Ks are like 9 to 3, even if the kid's only 2.5 years old. I mean, everything is different. The entire, you know, environment in which we operate is different. So I don't really want to sit here and say what's going to be better for the kids and what's, I mean, I think parents would certainly feel better if they weren't, you know, driving all over creation and making themselves nuts. Of course,
right.
I think everybody's mental health would improve, but, you know, I don't want to sit there and like berate any parents for going to these elaborate lengths. What I was doing was trying to figure out why they were going to these lengths.
You know, you were talking about pre-K, and I was thinking about separation issues with today's children,
yeah.
you know, and the parents, because it used to be that that going off to kindergarten was the earliest separation that kids would know from their parents. So now you have children that are going to daycare so much earlier. So
yep.
What effect does that have on the parents?
The biggest effect that I kept seeing was that women who work are getting such a plague of mixed messages. They just feel extraordinary guilt. And what happens is women drop off their kids at daycare or whatever it is, whatever childcare arrangement they've made. They go to work and then they come home and the shot clock is running again. And home is not a haven because they feel so guilty about having worked, many of them, that they immediately throw off their coat, get down on their hands and knees, and start playing with their kids. And they start playing with them in this very intensive way. It's like the full saturation, immersion version of play. It's not like saying, oh, hey, sweetie, and pecking them on the head and, you know, calling through the mail and, you know, getting a drink and sitting down and saying, how was your day? It's like getting down on hands and knees and playing Legos. And, you know, if they're going to get, like, dinner going, they're also going to be, like, trying simultaneously to really be playing with their Legos. So I think what most working women don't realize is that, again, they are spending more time with their children than mothers did in the 1960s. Because in the 60s, what mothers were doing was putting their kids in playpens or telling their kids to go out and play with their neighbors, and they would see them again at 6. And what mothers were doing was keeping impeccable houses. They were cleaning the house. They were making meals. They were doing volunteer work and hanging out with their neighbors. They were doing other kinds of stuff. Now, in the main, most moms, like, aren't, you know, hanging out with the neighbors and, you know, doing that volunteer work. Their houses are filthy, according to the American Time Use Survey. No one cleans our houses. Our houses are wrecks. And our houses, and nobody, and no one cooks, right? And this is all documented. This is all borne out in really terrific granular data kept by the American Time Use Survey. What women do instead is all that energy that used to go into keeping, like, a great home goes into building elaborate Lego models, right? And so, like, what happens is, you know, as a result of kind of dropping your kid off at daycare, like, you are just besieged by guilt, particularly as a mother. And also, you know, there's a lot of conflicting data out there that I just think is really fascinating. Like, you know, more Americans than ever think it's perfectly great and fine for women to be the primary breadwinner. That's great. More American women, but also more Americans than ever think that someone should be home full time with the child. That is a really mixed message.
Right.
It suggests that we are deeply ambivalent about women in the workforce. Because imagine both of those happening simultaneously. I mean, people are on the one hand saying, sure, terrific, you go, girl, you bring home that bacon. And on the other hand, they're saying, oh, it's really important that someone be home every minute with the baby or with the child. I mean, those are irreconcilable in a way, unless they're saying that they think that dads should quit their jobs.
Right, right. Well, it was interesting when you brought up the division of labor, and I was talking earlier with someone. Do you think fathers do less? Why do mothers do? What percentage is it, by the way?
Right. No, it's a great question. Okay, so in terms of the averages, this might not be true in your home. It's the American Time Use data, which, again, there are just thousands of samples, and it's very granular, suggests that women do about twice as much childcare. However, the ledgers balance out fairly evenly because men work more paid hours, women work more unpaid hours.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, even though women are now in the main, in the paid workforce, they're not working the same number of hours as their husbands. So the kind of fights that this sets up are the following. Mom has worked outside the home, or maybe inside the home, for money, you know, for some number of hours. And then she stops, and then, you know, she starts doing the childcare stuff. And she's the one who's doing the deadline-sensitive stuff because, again, this has been borne out in, you know, time use data and in other social science studies. Women do more of the, like, things that, you know, are kind of on a schedule and involve pressure points. You know, they're making the dinner, they're checking the homework, they're getting the bath run, they're, you know, getting the soccer uniform laundered by the next day when the kid needs it. They're picking somebody up by a certain time. So they feel a different kind of pressure on the domestic front, and it's like the shot clock is running immediately. So home is not a haven. Home is still a stressful place. Whereas dad comes home, he's worked really hard. He's been multitasking all day at work, and he tends to come home. And men, when they are at home, tend to do just one thing at a time, whereas women tend to do many things at a time.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this is based on very good data. So the wife looks at the husband and says, why aren't you, you know, kicking in here? And the husband says, what do you mean? I have been kicking it. I've been working my tail off all day and I'm tired. And I also did X, Y, and Z this week and I'm about to do something else. You know, it's not like they're doing nothing. And compared to their fathers, they're doing plenty.
Mm-hmm.
And they are reporting more work-life conflict now than their wives because, you know, they're starting to experience it. They're starting to feel alive to it. And I'm betting they are finding a lot of inflexibility in their own workplaces about when they can leave. And, you know, so it's this very kind of tense inflection point, inflection moment, I think, in American domestic life where, like, our scripts are just non-existent for how to hash out, you know, these new and changing and rapidly evolving norms, norms.
Let's take a call from Flavio, who's been waiting for a while in Fort Lauderdale. Flavio, welcome to Topical Currents.
Well, hi, how you doing?
How are you?
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. I just have this comment that, I'm 39 years old, and that when I talk to, other people that are in my income level, that they think that having a kid is just something like something that is not in their future and something they cannot afford to have in the future. It's just sad. It just simply seems like that's just going to damage in the long run because there's not going to be population of children because it's just something you cannot afford. It sounds sad.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Okay. I mean, it is true.
Excuse me for a minute. Flavio, it's a little noisy in the background there. Do you mind if I just say, if you take your answer off the air?
No problem.
Okay, thank you very much for calling. Okay, go ahead, Jennifer.
Yeah, no, it was a great comment, but it sounded like a car window was open. It was
funny. Think so.
It was a really worthwhile comment. I think it's worth addressing. I mean, on the one hand, objectively speaking, kids are expensive. The Department of Agriculture kind of looks at this. I don't know if they do it annually, but I know that they estimated that a kid born in 2010 would cost a middle class family $295,000 to raise.
Mm.
And that doesn't include college. So, that's for a middle class family. They had different calculations for wealthier families and for poorer families. So on the one hand, objectively speaking, it is expensive. On the other hand, I think he is speaking to something that's very real, which is that, like, if you just go in with the attitude that, like, we are going to sweep in this kid and work around it and figure out how to make a child a part of our lives, then you just do it. Whereas I think something about deferring children only exaggerates people's anguish about the price tag associated with raising children. Because what you do first is you get married, you find your house, you get your mortgage, you establish yourself in your careers. And in all these ways, and then suddenly, you know, and then you have a kid because you feel like that's when you can afford it. But there's a different way of thinking about having children, which is just that, like, we're going to make this work. The people who pay the biggest penalty often for this are women, that if they defer child rearing, their own earning potential does go up substantially if they can hold off until after 30. But, you know, that creates all sorts of other problems, including the psychological roadblocks that Flavio was talking about and the fertility questions. You know, I mean, it's immensely complicated.
Paul wants to know if parents feel the need to push their kids to overachieve because they see so many educated adults struggling in the workplace.
I think that speaks exactly to the kind of economic anxiety that I was speaking about. When you have middle class wages stagnating and you've got, you know, for the first time, not for the first time, but we now have, I think, a generation of men and women who look around and go, wow, you know, job security, what's that? You know, I think that is extremely unnerving, mm-hmm. you know, and makes parents, you know, go to elaborate lengths to assure that their kids are not, you know, are well prepared. There are other reasons too, though. Let me just point out, a lot of parents are enrolling their kids in things after school because they don't have daycare. And this is a form of daycare if you enroll your kids in a lot of after-school activities. And churches provide them, and, you know, after-school public, you know, there are some well-funded public school systems that provide after-school activities, you know, so that there's simply a place to put your children while you are at work. Kids, you know, parents enroll their kids in after-school activities so that their kids are not playing Xbox. you know, so that they are doing other things, so that their kids are physical.
Right.
They enroll their kids in after-school activities because they live in exurbs, which are very far away from other children. You know, there's just too much sprawl where they live, and they want their kids to see other kids. And, you know, our families are getting smaller, so, you know, they might not interact with, you know, siblings because they don't have fewer of them or they don't have any, you know. I mean, so there are all kinds of reasons why we do this.
We're speaking with Jennifer Senior, and her book is All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. If you want to join in the conversation, number's 1-800-743-9576. Any views that you have on parenthood or how you were parented, 1-800-743-9576, or email radio@wlrn.org. And Carla in Miami has a question. Hi, Carla.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a few points. I don't know if I can cover them all, but I think there's some environmental things that are fairly recent. One is our movement toward magnet schools from local schools. They're further away. They don't have the local children together in one school close to their neighborhood so that those relationships cross over, and that they, you know, you meet people in your vicinity. Another thing is that, you know, I think you touched on it before, that when we were kids, you know, we would just be sent outside to play, and if you were back by dinner, you were okay. Well, you know, that's not a reality anymore. We can't just send our kids out into the street, and that means that we have to supervise during those times when it wasn't necessary before, when they had more independence and more, they could learn on their own more, that gave them more self-confidence. And now, of course, as parents, we don't have time always to do that, you know, to be there all the time when the kid needs supervision if they're not old enough. and so free time is kind of, it's not well used.
Well, let's let Jennifer comment. Jennifer?
Those are both such great points. The magnet school one is particularly excellent. I don't think anyone has ever raised that with me. And it's very consistent with something that I write about a lot, which is the kind of attenuated relationships that we have with our neighbors and the attenuating sense of community that we have. And, you know, the fact that, I mean, in general, Americans have, you know, reported feeling more isolated. Not, the internet and Facebook and all those things notwithstanding, social media is great glue, but for parents, you really need embodied contact with people. And, you know, Robert Putnam, who wrote Bowling Alone, he's a Harvard sociologist, wrote this, you know, great defining book in 2000 called Bowling Alone, talked a lot about this, that, you know, we see far less of our neighbors than we used to. You know, we don't know our neighbors as well. And very recently, Americans reported having fewer close friends than they used to. It's harder to find. So, you know, there's that bit. And if you combine, like, this driving all over creation that, yes, our communities are more far flung because, you know, our schools are no longer right there. I mean, I think that also because we have exurbs now, right, there's sprawl. Sprawl accounts for some of this. And also what you're saying, that, you know, we're shuttling our kids to the other end of the city in some cases to go to school so that we don't have, like, kind of the neighborhood school effect. That's true. And that leads right into this second point about, right, we don't send our kids out into the street. There are fewer children to send into the street. That's number one. Number two, it's simply convention. You know, there's no real reason why we shouldn't send our kids out into the street. If there are a few people on your block, then that's obviously problematic. You know, I mean, we're living further apart from one another and all that. But in densely populated places, I was very surprised. Like, when I was in a ravishing suburb of Houston, no one was sending their children out into the streets, and I could not understand why, not even their yards. And their yards were just lusciously landscaped and looked terrific. And everybody was very anxious about kidnappings,
right,
and crimes against kids. And all I could think was, the kidnappings are at record lows. Crimes against children are at record lows right now. It's probably never been safer to send your child out into the street. bike accidents are down, and maybe that's because we don't send our kids out into the street, but it could also be because kids wear helmets, you know, and cars are better. So, you know, they have more attuned brakes. So I'm interested in, I mean, it would be so nice if we all made the agreement that we would start resending our children out into the street. And, you know, there's obviously movements afoot and free-range parenting books and things like that that I think encourage that kind of, you know, revival of community that you're talking about.
Carla, is that okay?
Well, just one point. Statistics can go down if the kids aren't going out.
I said that, you know, we can't separate, except for that crimes against kids are also down. I mean, crime is down. Crime is down considerably nationwide against everyone. When we see, you know, a CNN report about a kidnapping five states away, the problem is that it still activates some part of a parent's brain that gets very, you know, anxious. And if you have transparent sex offender registries in your state, if you can go online and see these things, then that transparency has some kind of chilling effect on your desire to put your kid out in the street, even though those numbers were probably much worse 20 and 30 years ago. You just didn't know about them, you know?
Right.
So I think that that's, in some ways, the crucial difference. Not all of the numbers. I mean, maybe, you know, bike accidents have gone down because we're so reluctant to put our kids out on bikes, but it doesn't explain the you know, dip nationwide in crime, you know, I mean, against everyone. And those are for other reasons, and reasons we should feel encouraged by as parents, and yet we don't.
How do parents today deal with, it used to be okay to say for an answer, because I said so. I don't think that parents do that anymore. Do you do that?
I do. I know. I do. Yeah.
It's still acceptable?
Well, no. And I tend to give a slightly more elaborated answer. I mean, I tend to say, because I know what's better for you, and that the house is not a democracy. Not that my son knows what a democracy is. He's only six. But, you know, but I say, you're going to have to trust me. I know what's best for you. And the answer is no. And that is not the most right. We don't tend to do that. I think the middle class approach tends to be one that is, you know, we answer questions with questions. And that's not my work. That's the work of Annette LaRue. She's a terrific sociologist who pointed this out in one of her landmark books called Unequal Childhood. She pointed out that, you know, working class and poor parents still often feel like they can say, you know, because I said so. Whereas middle class parents and upper middle class parents will say things like, well, what do you think of that? And they will give their kids a choice.
Right.
And my sense, she doesn't talk about this, but my guess is that, at least I don't think she talks about this. Maybe she does, and I've forgotten. My guess is that each parent is aping the kind of customs of their workplace, which is to say, if you're middle class, you work in a collaborative, open pen workplace where everybody calls each other by their first names and you collaborate and, you know, it's not as hierarchical. Whereas if you're working class or you're poor, you have a boss and, you know, you answer to them and your boss can, you know, what your boss says goes, and you learn to, you know, because I said so is the answer in your world. Whereas, you know, in middle class office environments, you're lucky enough to be able to argue with your colleagues.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they import those kind of customs and structures into their own home. That's my guess.
That's interesting. We're speaking with Jennifer Senior, and she's an award-winning journalist and a contributing editor at New York Magazine. Her book is All Joy and No Fun: The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. We're going to take a short break. Evan, when we come back, stay there and we'll take your call.
We're funded by listeners like you and by ASAP Staffing Services, an executive staffing firm serving Miami, Fort Lauderdale, and Boca Raton. Committed to providing clients with experienced talent. More information at 305-961-1185, or you can find open positions at asap.jobs.
Celebrate Mother's Day and support WLRN at the same time by making a $120 contribution at WLRNradio.org.
As our thank you, we'll send your mom a basket of roses, petunias, and more from Field of Flowers.
All it takes is a $120 contribution at WLRNradio.org, and we'll send the flowers anywhere in the U.S. in time for Mother's Day.
You're going to send the flowers. You want to support WLRN. Do them both now at WLRNradio.org or call 1-866-247-9576.
And speaking of mothers, yes, we're speaking about the book All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood, with New York Magazine contributing editor Jennifer Senior. And before any more questions, Evan, welcome to Topical Currents.
Yeah, hello, this is Evan.
Yes, go ahead.
This is concerning the super child, maybe not directly to the point, but I have a friend who graduated from or went to an Ivy League university. This would be 1966 or thereabouts. Came from a successful family, went to a prep school that was meant to send you to an Ivy League school. And when he got in, his student advisor took him aside and said, "The reason we accepted you, because you're not the top of your class student," he said, "we could fill this freshman class every year with high school students who graduated first in their class. Half of them would be trying to jump out a window by Thanksgiving because they couldn't be first in the class anymore." Just the competition is so fierce.
Mm-hmm.
And now it's back to even younger children. I guess maybe it's an exaggeration, but people are sending their kids to tutors to get them into the right preschool so they can get into the right kindergarten so they can get into the right prep school.
Yeah, I live in a universe where that's extremely common.
Right.
I mean, New York is filled with those families, and I bet that, you know, your area is too. Yeah, I think that puts a lot of pressure on parents as well as children. I mean, I think that, you know, no one winds up feeling particularly good at the end of all that. And, you know, especially if, you know, the whole course of your life has been directed so much. I mean, I think that, you know, you don't have a chance to sort of enjoy things along the way, or when I think that you're probably right that failure might come as a shock. I mean, you know, it's hard for me to know. Again, I mean, I think that a whole lot of really good psychologists right now are looking at outcomes from this kind of stress and this kind of pressure. I was trying to look at the effect on mothers and fathers. I have no doubt that, you know, it's got to be very difficult for kids. I mean, it's hard to imagine any kind of pressure cooker environment sustaining itself for very long without needing to release steam, you know?
Yeah. Well, and there's only so many Nobel Prizes, but...
right. Okay, Evan.
Anyway,
thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for calling.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. What about... What about this modern phenomenon of parents wanting to be a friend to their children? Has this made parents less effective, do you think? Or have you studied
it? It's probably an extension of what... No, I think it's an extension of what you and I were just talking about, that when you answer questions with questions.
Right.
It's probably some, like, extension of the hierarchy being... Or an outgrowth of this flattened hierarchy, right? Where... if you don't see yourself as like the figure of authority, but rather as an equal, then at some point one can imagine that morphing into befriending a child rather than trying to direct a child and, you know, impose discipline and impose norms and structure. So again, I'm not faulting parents for doing this. There's a reason we all got here. This is now how it goes. I mean, and again, in part because. I think the middle class suddenly found their offices, you know, looking like Google with beanbags and open planning and everyone calling. Look, when I came of age in the workforce, I called the most senior person in my office by his first name. As a 22-year-old, I was looking at, you know, a 60-something-year-old and who was a giant in his field. I still called him by his first name because that is the kind of, you know, office environments that, you know, starting in the 90s, we began to see, and probably earlier even. So it's not really an accident that parents are going to be recreating those environments unconsciously in their homes.
Right.
I know how it happened. You know.
Exactly.
So
you were
I don't.
There.
Again, I'm not faulty. I was there. Right. Exactly. So I really don't want to pass judgment. I want everybody to just know that, like, they're not alone if they're doing these things. You know, we all got here because we were all on board the same train. We just didn't really realize it. But I do think, yes, of course it makes disciplining your kid harder and making, Of course it makes your parenting life harder. How could it not? You're supposed to be responsible for your child. So if you're mistakenly, unconsciously befriending them and speaking in the language of friendship mm-hmm. rather than the language of, you know, like authoritative affection, there's going to be a difference.
What about the adolescent years? You say that they're much more of a struggle for the parents than for the children. We know how hard they are for the children. Why is that? Are you saying because they affect the marriage, if there's not a strong bond between the parents, those adolescent years? Why is it harder for parents?
Yeah, you're definitely touching down on part of it. I'm actually citing the work of this fellow named Lawrence Steinberg, who's really, really good. He's an adolescence researcher, and he's one of the few who has actually also looked at the effect of adolescence on parents, as well as the effect of parents on adolescents. He's looked at both populations, which is pretty nifty. And he's the one who found that actually parents in some ways go through the bigger crisis and have the bigger dips in mental health, which is not to trivialize the experience of adolescence for some kids, because some kids really suffer. Really, really suffer, particularly if they're gay or they're overweight or, you know, if they're depressed or if they're, you know, just different in an environment that, you know, really values homogeneity and conformity. But he points out that lots of adolescents also kind of pass through that phase in a kind of daze, you know, that they're not as attuned to these things as we think they are.
Okay.
Whereas parents feel their children detaching, and they really feel it. And here's what happens. When your kid is in ninth grade, they're still spending about 35% of their waking hours with you. This is not the work of Steinberg, but the work of some. I saw this terrific, very like this sample that was just huge that had been done in Michigan that was really well done. It looked like adolescents were essentially spending about 35% of their waking hours with their parents in ninth grade. But by 12th grade, that had dropped, I can't remember, down to the teens. It was something like 14%, I think. So imagine as a parent what that feels like. You know, you've come home or you've been in the home and your kid has shown you nothing but affection, and then suddenly they're doing their own thing and they might even be hostile. They might even be rejecting you. They might even be deeply critical of who you are. And if you don't have other sources of fuel, that's pretty traumatic. I mean, it exposes all these other holes in your life. If your adolescent is rejecting you, you're going to suddenly be looking at your husband or your wife wanting affirmation. But if your marriage is weak, you're suddenly going to really notice it.
Mm-hmm.
You might be looking to your job for affirmation. But if you don't like your job or you don't have a job and you want one, you're going to really notice it. If you're looking to your friends for affirmation or your church or your synagogue or your hobbies and you suddenly discover that you don't like any of those, you're just kind of alone on a raft, you know? It's not, so you have to, I mean, everybody who's sort of entering adolescence, that's the one moment where I feel like I can actually say something, I can kind of give advice, because it seemed very clear to me that one strategy for parents as their kids are in adolescence is, or going into adolescence is, find a hobby, you know, make sure you like your job, make sure you've worked
right
on your marriage, just so that when your kid is pulling away, you know that you've got something to fall back on.
We're getting kind of short on time, so I want to talk about that Daniel Kahneman study and the findings. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you for bringing it up, because so many people just love dwelling on only the negative stuff, and they don't. And you've isolated by far the coolest and most profound thing, I think. So thank you very specifically for teeing it up.
Okay.
So this is Daniel Kahneman is he's a psychologist who won a Nobel Prize. He's a pretty bright guy. For, you know, inventing behavioral economics, basically. He pointed out that we have two selves. There's the self that goes through the world and does stuff in real time, and that's the experiencing self. And there's the remembering self, and that's the self that remembers the stuff we did, you know, and who arguably makes up our identity. You know, it's our collection of memories. The experiencing self probably suffers as a parent. Moment to moment, parenting is very stressful. You know, we are responsible for our kids' health and safety and well-being. We are telling them, do this, don't do that, don't jump off of that, it's too high, don't smoke pot, do your homework. You know, we're doing all these things, right, that can be hard. And we're having disagreements with our spouse about doing it, and it's a lot of energy. So in real time, parents seem to suffer. And that's what the data tends to show. However, the data is also pretty clear about something. We love nothing more than having parented or at the end of the day, the thing that we say gives us the most joy is our kids, because they do in some transcendent way. Those moments of kind of spectacular connection that we have with our kids don't have much rival in our lives. I mean, sometimes they do. You know, if you're standing at the top of Mount Kilimanjaro, it's great. And other people find other sources of meaning and nourishment. Not everyone finds this, you know, through parenthood. But many of us will say that the best moments, the moments we remember with the most sparkling clarity and the most beautiful moments, are with our own children. There's just no getting around it. And that's true in my own life. And so, you know, what I do as a parent now is I try and collect as many memories as I can, because I love remembering, like, the good stuff. I keep copious notes about all the funny things my kid says, you know, and I take more pictures now. I used to be very unsentimental, but I've started taking pictures just so I can remember stuff. You know, and even bad memories can be converted into good ones. If you think about those moments with your kid when you're rocking them and saying, please go to sleep. But then, like, 3 years later, all you remember is kind of the sense memory of that moment. Like, you remember them as the koala bear with their arms wrapped around your neck and your legs wrapped around your trunk, you know, your stomach. Right. And you think of them as the koala bear and you were the tree. And how you remember how they smelled. You remember what it felt like to be enveloped. So that that moment when they were, like, not going to bed in the middle of the night becomes a totally different memory. And it's like it lives in this special kind of suspended place of privilege in your memory and in your brain. It's kind of amazing.
So do you have, we have a few seconds left, if you want to share the most beautiful memory you have right now. Your son is 6 years old, is that right?
He's six. I'll tell you one thing that he said not that long ago that kind of blew me away. I started to blink back tears. He said, when I was born, I was so happy to see that it was you who was my mom, because you were the one I was waiting for. You were the one I wanted.
Ah.
I know.
That's beautiful.
I mean, yeah, right? Yeah. I mean, I don't know if it translates. Everybody says these great things that their kids say, and, you know, they're deeply individual and idiosyncratic, but we were in a public place and I just had to, like, get it together, you know?
I can imagine. Yeah. Well, thanks, Jennifer Senior. And
thank
she
you.
Is an award-winning journalist, contributing editor at New York Magazine, and the author of All Joy and No Fun, The Paradox of Modern Parenthood. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you. This was great.
Okay, it was our pleasure. And that wraps up today's Topical Currents. A pleasure to have you with us. Our producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction from producer online, Paul Leary, and free audio archives and links at our website, WLRN.org. Tomorrow at this time, the monthly meeting of the Miami-Dade County School Board. And we'll be back Thursday with Augustine Burroughs and Linda Gassenheimer. Bonnie Berman, hoping your Tuesday is a great day. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News. And thanks so much for being with us.